This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Ken Rudin's out sick today, but he will be joining us next Thursday, along with Howard Wilkinson for a discussion of the latest political news. Meantime, joining us from the Cincinnati Zoo and Botanical Garden to discuss the importance of protecting honeybees and local efforts to increase and sustain their populations and offer suggestions on plants you can grow to attract and feed pollinators such as bees and butterflies, our zoo beekeeper and one of the founders of Pollen Nation, Melanie Evans, Director of Horticulture, Steve Foltz, and horticulturist Scott Berline, who's also the chair of the Taking Root campaign. You can join our conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Melanie, Steve, and Scott, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for having us.
So, Scott, it's not just bees and butterflies. There are a lot of different pollinators, aren't there?
Hundreds of different pollinators, lots of native bees, native wasps, flies, beetles, butterflies, moths, birds, mammals. So a lot of things pollinate plants. Some are obviously more proficient or common than others, but there's a lot out there.
Steve, what makes the pollinators so important? Why are they so crucial?
Well, obviously without pollinators, you're not going to have any fruits or seeds, so every third bite we take is from a bee, thanks to our pollinators. And so I think that's the important thing. And, we've become so urban. And, probably 70, 80% of the population lives in urban areas now. And, we've kind of forgot that farming aspect in the urban community. So I think it's our responsibility, like the Cincinnati Zoo and Botanical Garden, to kind of become a model of, the new urban landscape and the new urban ecosystem, which I think is becoming more and more important.
And besides pollinating plants and flowers, the pollinators also play some other important roles, don't they?
Well, absolutely. I mean, like I said, for me, it's all about the plants because the, having a wide diversity of plant material really helps out the whole ecosystem. And, that's what we're looking for, whether it's shade, trees for birds and habitat. And, trees in particular, a lot of insects feed on trees. And then their larvae, the birds eat the larvae and feed their young. And so it's a whole system. It's not just about any one flower or one bee or one pollinator.
Right. A lot of those pollinators, the native bees, the wasps, and flies, they're actually parasitizers or predators of pest insects. So the more that you're promoting pollinators in the garden, frequently, the less you have problems with those pests and those problems. We notice that at the zoo with the diverse plantings that we have because we just don't have any significant pest problems on a routine basis. We don't spray. We don't have issues. And partly it's because of a good, balanced ecosystem that promotes beneficial insects that keep the garden running smoothly.
So, Melanie, how's the pollinator population doing? I mean, what's happening to it?
It's on a decrease, and that's not very good because, the bees feed us. And as our population increases and their population decreases, that leaves us a little bit of an issue. So there's that buzzword, pun intended, with colony collapse disorder. And just like anything ecologically, it's not a simple cause or a simple solution to it. There's many different variables that are affecting the bees. And so the bees, I would say the average beekeeper is having about a 30 to 40% loss in their honeybees for the captive bees that they're keeping. So that's a very easy number that we can manage just because they're captive bees. But the wild bees are also on a decline as well. So we're in a little bit of a trouble, but we have some advice for how we can manage that.
And how long has this been going on, Melanie? I mean, when did people first notice that the bee population was declining, and how did they take notice of this?
It was about 10 years ago. About like I said, 10 years ago, beekeepers started noticing the decline, and they didn't know what was going on. The colony collapse was this huge mystery where they noticed the bees were disappearing. They weren't coming back. Or when the beekeepers would come back from the winter time, check in the hive, there wouldn't be any bees in there, or a very small cluster of dead bees in the bottom of the hive. So it's increased since then. So it's something that was a mystery for a while, but I think there's been a lot of research, very, very broad array of studies done on the bees to figure out what's going on. And like I said, it's not a simple thing. There's many things going on in our environment that's causing this decline.
Any what in particular is attributed to this?
Yeah, so one of the big ones are the chemicals that we're spraying on our plants. So the chemicals, people are spraying them either on their agricultural crops or in their gardens or lawns. And as you know, the bees go and visit those plants. The chemicals cover their bodies. And it doesn't just affect that one individual bee, but they go back to their hive their colony. And they're so involved in touching every part of that hive. They go and they care for their baby bees. They care for the eggs. They store their honey. So those chemicals get enthralled into all of those aspects not just that one individual bee, but the entire life of that entire colony. And so it affects the colony so much. So if you have thousands of foraging bees going out and collecting these chemicals and bringing it back to their hives, that's going to make a huge effect.
And it's what effect would you say the loss of habitat is having? I mean, there's a lot of development going on, so I think that would have to have an impact too.
Absolutely. So habitat degradation and forest degradation is also kind of a huge significant factor to their decline. If you do not have food available for the bees, they're going to go hungry. And in addition to that, there's also not a lot of plant diversity. So they're kind of malnourished. They don't have a lot of broad spectrum nourishment in their food that they're getting. So it's really important, as Scott and Steve will be talking about, that we not only plant plants for pollinators, but a diverse array and things that will have really beneficial nectars and pollens for all of the different types of pollinators, not just honeybees.
How much of a problem is people spraying dandelions on their lawn? Is that another issue?
That's a huge issue. For beekeepers, we know that one of the first feedings for bees that will come and bloom are dandelions. So it's really important that they have those available. And people love to spray those things.
Yeah, they don't like dandelions. They like to get rid of them. Scott, it's not just bees, though. I mean, most of the pollinators have experienced some kind of a decline in their population.
The same pressures on honeybees are on all the other, you know, beneficial insects also. So lack of diversity, lack of or increase in development, loss of habitat, all of that, it has the same effect. And that's why it's so important for people to garden more, to get, you know, get more plants into this urban community that we've built. It's a challenge, I know, for young people to try to garden. People are busier than they've ever been. Space is more limited. Money is limited. Expertise is limited. But it's to get plants, flowers, trees into your garden and more if you already have some is one of the most important things you can do for the environment.
So what happens if this decline continues?
We'll go hungry.
Yeah, do we want to go there?
Literally.
We're going to eat processed foods. I mean, like Steve said, one out of every three bites of food that we eat are pollinated by honeybees alone. That's just honeybees, and that doesn't include all of the other beneficial insects and pollinators Scott was talking about. So these pollinators give us our food, and without that, we're going to be eating everything that was developed on a platelet. That's not the kind of diet I want.
Okay, 513-419-7100 to join the conversation, and Arnell in Clifton joins us now. Hi, Arnell.
Hello. I have a question for you today. We have carpenter bees, and we're aware that they are pollinators and are trying to come up with a solution or an agency that can help us deal with the problem. They're in our deck and around our roof line.
So carpenter bees, I will say, they do burrow into your wood structures. I've heard that they don't burrow very deep, and definitely not enough to compromise the structural integrity of your deck or your roof or whatever. I honestly say leave them. But if you're really that worried about it, there's not a very humane or nice way to get rid of them. I've heard you really just have to spray them and patch up the hole. But a good way to prevent them, that's the best way I would say, is to you just basically cover any of your wood. You don't want to have any exposed raw wood. That's what they like to burrow into. So using really thick primers or sealants on your wood is a good way to prevent them.
Now, I've heard also that, you know, you can kind of create for or a habitat for them with boards or dead wood that you've left in, you know, tree trunks or something safely somewhere in the yard, and that they tend to come back to the same location every year. So if you can maybe encourage them away from your house by having other wood around for them to bore into, I don't know if that's exactly true, but it's a thought. It's something you could look into.
No, I've seen that actually at, I can't remember what park it was. It was a local park. They had a piece of raw wood set right above their eave on their building. And it was to encourage carpenter bees to go into that and avoid the painted, treated wood of their actual building. So that's a really good alternative solution too.
And Steve, we know you're about plants, but you have any thoughts on carpenter bees yourself?
I don't have any. They don't sting, so... Or at least I've never, you can almost literally touch them, and but that doesn't help your wood. So
we will continue our conversation, and we'll take your calls at 513-419-7100. You can also email us at talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Joining us to discuss protecting honeybees and local efforts to increase and sustain their populations and to offer suggestions on plants you can grow to attract and feed pollinators are Cincinnati Zoo and Botanical Garden beekeeper and one of the founders of Pollen Nation, Melanie Evans, Director of Horticulture, Steve Foltz, and Horticulturist Scott Berline, who's also chair of the Taking Root campaign. You can be part of the conversation at 513-419-7100. Email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us at Facebook or Twitter. Steve, you wanted to talk some more about the issue of using chemicals and treating plants.
Yeah, I think a lot of us, you know, have, you know, there's lawn care applications that are pretty common in most neighborhoods. And, you know, the one thing that we've observed or found that if you spray that while, say, clover's in full bloom, that's when you don't want to make any chemical applications. So the key thing on any pesticide application is not spraying a plant while it's in bloom. And that's probably the one tip that, you know, just make sure that if your lawn's in full bloom with clover, don't make the chemical application at that time. Now, again, at the zoo, we use very little, if any, pesticides. And the reason for that is not because we're worried about killing off all the insects. It's we don't need to because we use such a wide diverse of really good plant material. You know, that's what our plant trials program's all about. It's selecting plants that don't get insects, that don't have problems and issues that you have to baby and spray all the time. So there's several plants that a lot of people spray locally, just, you know, roses, I'd say, are probably one of the tough ones. I mean, it's a tough plant to grow. And that's why knockout roses became so popular, because you don't really have to spray them for a whole lot of things. But again, the better selection you make on plant material, the less insect problems you're going to have. And, you know, that therefore you don't need to use pesticides to control insects. And the other side to that is if you apply any pesticide on your plants, you're not only killing the pest on the plant, you're killing the beneficials, and you're also killing the predatory insects that are kind of keeping nature in balance there. So there's been a lot of research shown that the more you spray, the more insect problem you actually have. So, you know, that's why we don't spray.
So the better solution is, as you're saying, is to use high quality plants.
Better plants, prepare your soil, make sure your soil's right, and then just good garden care.
And we'll talk about this some more later, but you brought up the list that the zoo has been compiling. And what is that list?
Well, over the last 20, 25 years, we've been working on what we call the zoo's best list. And it's the zoo's best trees, the zoo's best shrubs, the zoo's best perennials, the zoo's best annuals. And all these lists are over years of studying and researching these plants in our local region. And basically, we've come up with many lists of recommended plants that we can use in Cincinnati that are, they're cold hardy. They don't require a lot of care. Now, when I say that, though, there is obviously general garden care. You water when it's dry, that kind of thing. But, overall, it's a good solid list of plant material, whether it's trees, shrubs, perennials, annuals. We're trying to make it the home gardener in Cincinnati successful. We want the region to be beautiful. And by using these lists, that's what we're kind of recommending locally.
513-419-7100 to join us. Let's talk with Bob in Clifton. Hi, Bob.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Very interesting discussion. I have a question about captive bees and colony collapse disorder or syndrome, whatever it's called. I have read somewhere that captive bees are trucked all around and they're constantly working. They work a field or whatever, and then they get boxed up and trucked to a new location. And that this was putting a stress on the captive bees because they're working so hard, and because at any one time they're only exposed to one crop instead of a diverse diet. And I wondered if your panelists could comment on that, whether that's accurate or not, and if they could elaborate on that a little bit.
Okay.
Yes, absolutely. That is, that's been going on for many years, ever since we've had the agricultural style of growing our food. And so in order to have thousands of apple trees pollinated at the exact time that it's in bloom, it's really crucial for those trees to get pollinated at the time of bloom. And so the way to do that is to have a commercial-sized beekeeper bring several hundred hives and basically dump them off at that site, have them pollinate those trees. And what they usually do is they go on a tour across the United States to all the different crop fields. So they'll pollinate, blueberries up in Michigan and apples, and go out to California and do almonds and wherever else they plant those things. I don't know all of it. But that occurs. And that the problem doesn't lie there, but it is a stressor that affects the bees when they have all of the other environmental stressors going on. So, if they're malnourished because of plant degradation, or getting one type of nourishing plant as their food, or they have the chemicals that they're exposed to, and in addition to that, they're dealing with the cold winters, it lowers their immune system. They become a less hardy animal. And so, it's not just one thing causing colony collapse disorder. It's multiple things. But again, that is one significant stressor to them, is that we are really overworking these bees to meet the demands of feeding all of the people.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join the conversation. You can also email us at talk@wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And James in Mount Washington joins us now. Hi, James.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, thank you.
I just wanted to point out something. I wanted to make a slight correction to something one of your panelists said just earlier, mentioning carpenter bees not being damaging to wood enough to cause structural breakdown. Actually, I've had many instances of carpenter bees digging into 4x4s, especially on decks and in mailbox posts, so much so that when I replaced my most recent mailbox post, which was untreated lumber — the key is you need treated lumber because they don't like the taste of it and will stay away from burrowing into it. Painting it works good, but treated lumber is the best. But they had burrowed so much into the 4x4 that was the mailbox post that with one hit of a hammer from the side, the entire thing disintegrated.
Wow.
So they could be potentially dangerous with decks.
Okay.
Well, that was a statement that I was given by our invertebrate curator, and so I think that's probably a rare occurrence, if anything. I'm not sure. But I just heard that they don't burrow very deep, so it could have just been that they had been there for a really long time.
But multiple burrows over a number of years could work through the weaken the wood, and yeah, load-bearing wood, you got to be careful.
Yeah. So 513-419-7100. Kathy in North Avondale joins us. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, I had a question about milkweed vines. They seem to be a favorite among the bees on our property, but they also tend to be invasive, and I'm worried about them overtopping some of our trees and pawpaw plants. And I was wondering if you had an idea about a better way to manage them or whether or not I should totally eradicate them.
A little confused because you said milkweed vines. I'm wondering if you meant morning glory vines?
You know, we had an arborist visit our property, and he said that they were milkweed vines, and when I went online to look at them, they were identical.
So these are vines that grow on fences and kind of have big, fluffy, trumpety flowers?
Or are they... Yeah, they're not flowering currently, but it's almost an underground network of vines when I try and dig them up, and they sprout out of these pods, these long, sort of pointed pods, and when they're in full bloom, they tend to just take over a plant to the point where that plant underneath can't get enough sunlight.
Well, milkweed, there's two kinds of things going on. Milkweeds are entirely native plants. A few can be somewhat aggressive, but not usually, and these are plants that are particularly good for monarchs and butterflies, but bees enjoy them too. These are beneficial plants. If they're aggressive and you don't want them in your garden, you might want to just dig out or grub out the plant, divide it. If you have to, go ahead and use an herbicide to kill it. Alternative, what I think you probably are dealing with, though, is one variation on bindweed or field weed or morning glories. A vine that tends to show up on fence rows a lot. It's a really aggressive weed. It's probably fairly beneficial to pollinators, but it is a nuisance in yards and gardens. It is hard to eradicate. It probably will require that you use either an herbicide like glyphosate over many applications, or just persistently cut it back over years.
Again, 513-419-7100 if you'd like to join us. And let's talk with Evelyn in Blue Ash. Hi, Evelyn.
Oh, hello. Oh, come on, line. Yes, I have a comment about dandelions. I let this sea of dandelions grow front and backyard at our house, which we just bought. And there were no bees. I was so disappointed. I mean, I went out in the morning, in the afternoon, in the evening, and they would have had a feast. But is that something that might have been caused by something like pesticides in the dandelions? And then my other question is, I'd like to put in a couple of fruit trees that require very little maintenance or any pesticide, and I was wondering whether mulberries would be good.
Okay, Evelyn, thank you for the call.
So I'll be happy to answer your bee question. I will say that with honeybees that are kept captive by a beekeeper, they will usually travel around a 3-mile radius from their hives. So it could be that you just don't have any neighbors that are beekeepers. But to speak for the plant life around your neighborhood, I'm not sure if there's a lot of other things that would draw in other native pollinators or bees that would make them want to think that that's a really novel area to go and forage from. So it could just be that there's not much else, or maybe there's a better area for pollen or nectar sources elsewhere that's nearby that's drawing them to it.
And as far as your question about, I believe, fruit trees, mulberries...
I would not do the mulberry.
Okay. Why is that, Steve?
They're a little messy, a little weedy. It's not worth putting that in. There's a lot of better fruit trees, I think, that you could get some out of. So Just my opinion.
Growing a sour cherry for years called Montmorency, or really any of the sour cherries, I think, are really easy to grow without use of pesticides. And then there's native fruits like persimmons or pawpaws. Absolutely no requirement for pesticides at all. When you start getting into apples, pears, sweet cherries, peaches, it gets a lot trickier. There's ways to do it organically, but it's tough.
And all those are going to be an attraction for pollinators.
Oh, absolutely. They bear a lot of – or are very floriferous this time of year or earlier, a good time of year for bees and pesticide – or and beneficial pollinators to get that early nourishment of nectar. So a lot of those are very beneficial plants in the garden, unless you spray them, and then they're not.
Let's talk with Mike in Warren County. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, thank you.
Good. I just wanted to comment that I've been a beekeeper for almost 40 years now. I like dandelions and I like mulberries, but I live out in the country, so a messy tree isn't that big of a problem. But recently, my house was invaded by carpenter bees, and I tolerated it for a couple years, but then I realized my old house has wooden sashes, and some parts of the sash are less than an inch thick. And when they burrow in there, they definitely destroy the sash. But I looked up online and found some carpenter beetle traps that I'd like to recommend. I put some out about 2 weeks ago, and I caught a few of them. Yesterday, I emptied 9 out of one trap, and I think my sashes are going to live. I've got plenty of dead wood and wood for them to live on, and I've got an old barn that's fallen down that they can eat. But I don't want them going after my sashes.
But you were able to trap them and then move them, is what you're saying.
You know, I didn't move them. They don't last long in the trap. But maybe I should move them. That would require driving several miles and dropping them off. And when I got 9 in one day, I would have been driving all day to get rid of them. So, you know, I think there's plenty for them to eat out, you know, besides my sashes. So,
okay. Maybe you could call Uber or something and have them delivered out.
That's a good idea.
Mike,
the bees will pay for their trip out. I'm not going to pay for it.
Mike, thank you for the call. We appreciate it. 513-419-7100 to join the conversation. Melanie, do you want to add anything more about the bees, the carpenter bees?
Yeah, the carpenter bees. I think bottom line is you just have to treat or paint your wood to prevent them from coming in. Whether they damage your personal structures or not, it depends on who you talk to. Because I've heard some people say that they've burrowed in their buildings for years. I have one of my buildings at the zoo. I have carpenter bees in there. I've had them in there for years and hadn't had an issue. But I know that they like to burrow in things that are larger than like 2 inches in width. So anyways, bottom line, just use the preventative care. If you don't want carpenter bees to burrow in your wood, treat it or paint it.
Again, 513-419-7100 to join us. Let's say hi to Mark in Delhi. Mark, how are you this afternoon?
I'm doing well.
Go right ahead.
I have a question for the representative of the zoo. The city of Cincinnati has an ordinance that basically says that a property owner needs to keep all vegetation below a 10-inch level, and they make exceptions for mature trees and mature bushes. But other than that, you're to keep all vegetation below a 10-inch level. And this seems like it would be very detrimental to pollinating insects. And I'm wondering if the zoo has worked with the city on this issue.
Well, I can answer no, we have not worked on that with the city. And that's an interesting thing because all around the country there's been issues like that. And half the time it's almost because, you know, people get cited, but they're really just not caring for their landscape. I think, you know, as long as it makes sense and it's naturalistic and it looks pleasing, I don't see any problem with it. And I think you could work with the city on that. But, you know, that is an issue that's been going on around the country.
Let's speak with Andrew in Avondale. Hi, Andrew.
Yes, the question of those milkweed vines, there's two plants that have a common name of milkweed, which are rather different. The vines, I don't know any common name for them other than milkweed. They do have somewhat similar seed. They both have, you know, a fluffy seed that flies in the air, but that's the only big point of resemblance. And they're in the vines are not the things that monarchs like. The milkweeds that monarchs like are erect plants. And there's about, I think, about 4 or 5 species of them that like different environments. There's 3 milkweed seeds you can get, and there's like a mixture of several different species.
That's the problem with common names is, you know, it leads to this kind of ambiguity. If it's in the genus Asclepias, it's a true milkweed and has all the benefits thereof. If it's in the bindweed family, it's Ipomea or possibly some other genus. But if you have a way of looking it up on Google or somewhere else and coming up with the scientific name, that's probably the basis of figuring out the issue.
Actually, that kind of leads us into actually talking about plants and pollinators. Plants in general, I think one of the most popular plants for pollinators are Asclepias. Those are the milkweed family, and you have common milkweed. You've got, there's an annual milkweed that just the monarchs just flock to. It's a beautiful, it's called silky red milkweed. There's a the native milkweed that has yellow flowers called Hello Yellow. Actually, we're at the zoo. We're actually started a program with the local retail garden centers and the local wholesale growers. And what we did is we got together with the annual growers and the perennial growers and started a program where what are the best plants for pollinators on the annual side, that means flowers that bloom all summer long and then they die, or the perennial side, where they come back year after year. And this program, we call it the Zoo's Best Plants for Pollinators, and it'll be in your retail garden centers all over the greater Cincinnati, northern Kentucky area. They have their own little pots with their labels on it. Hey, you know, we're pollinating the bees and the butterflies. We're helping feed wildlife. But it's a great assurance that, hey, these are great pollinator plants that have been tested locally and do really well and attract a wide range of pollinators.
And I counted the list. I think I came up with 45 annuals and 63 perennials that are on this list. So it's an extensive list. Where can people see that?
You can go to the zoo's website, and we have a Plants for Pollinators section on the garden section of the website. And hopefully they go in their local retail garden center, and there'll be displays of the zoo's best plants for pollinators. And, that really helps people, you know, distinguish whether, hey, is this one that will help pollinators out? But if you want to get very specific, if you want a monarch, there are very specific plants that monarchs like to flock to. If you want a pipe vine swallowtail, you probably ought to have a pipe vine in your yard. So, there's lots of interesting plants that bring in different butterflies and different bees.
We will continue our conversation and take your phone calls at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. My guest this afternoon, as we talk about pollinators such as bees and butterflies and to offer suggestions on plants you can grow to attract and feed pollinators, Cincinnati Zoo and Botanical Garden beekeeper and one of the founders of Pollen Nation, Melanie Evans, Director of Horticulture, Steve Foltz, and horticulturist Scott Berline, who's also chair of the Taking Root campaign. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And let's go to Jeff in Sharonville. Hi, Jeff.
Good afternoon. Wanted to see if your guests might be able to provide some information, educational resources, and potentially suppliers for those who might care to be a private beekeeper.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of support groups out there. We every year in the wintertime, we will start offering beekeeping courses. We did our first one just this last year at the Cincinnati Zoo. You can follow Cincinnati Zoo's Pollination on Facebook, and we keep you updated on that sort of thing. Or you can go on the Cincinnati Zoo's website. But in addition to that, if you have like a local beekeepers association, they have great mentorships. They'll have swap meets for equipment. So there's really good sources out there beyond just the zoo, but check those out.
Millie, what's Pollination? Tell us about that group.
Yeah, who are we? So Pollination, it's two words.
And it's clever too, Pollination.
Yeah, because we're a nation. We're trying to be a movement. Yeah, right. We're trying to be a movement of people that are spreading awareness for pollinators. We do focus a little bit more on honeybees, and we're just a bunch of enthusiasts from the zoo. We come from a diverse group of different positions in the zoo. To come together, we actually have an apiary out at our farm in Lebanon, and we also do education projects. We go to events. We're going to be at the Party for the Planet, which is at our Tunes and Blooms. It's a free event from 4 to 8:30 tonight at the zoo. You should show up there. We'll be there. But we do all kinds of things. So we also have offered a citizen science project to our guests. One other way that you can help bees, as I was talking about before, is you can log into beespotter.org. And that's a citizen science project that was started at the University of Illinois, where they've extended it to our Cincinnati tri-state. And you can help us learn more about the bee populations. We know a good amount about the honeybees, the European honeybees that are held captive, but wild bees, it goes for any bees. So just in this Midwest area, there's just over 2,000 different species of bees. So what you can do, because we don't expect you to identify all 2,000 species, is you can take a picture of that bee, upload it to beespotter.org, and we have an expert that's her primary job is to identify bee species, and she's going to basically identify that bee and put the data as to the location and the time, and we'll learn more about the bee populations. And with the citizen science project alone, we've learned about bees, certain species of bees existing in areas where we didn't know that they did exist. So you can get involved
with that. And that's BeeSpotters. Okay.
BeeSpotter.org.
Okay. And we should have a link to that at WVXU.org as well. So 513-419-7100 if you'd like to join us. Evelyn sent us an email, and she was asking how she can get rid of weeds in significantly weedy areas in her lawn without using chemicals. And she also wants to know, if she were to till this area, could you recommend a way to organically control the weed roots that have been tilled over? So now that my tongue's untwisted.
Well, first off, I want to remind everybody that, you know, a lot of the chemicals that are used, if they're used according to the label, they really are not a problem. It's when we use them that against label recommendations and spraying things while they're in flower.
Or is overuse a problem too, Steve?
Overuse is definitely a problem. And but when you have just small areas that you can hand control with, you know, sprays, that it really isn't, you know, going to cause a crisis on this. And I think sometimes we overstate that. However, if you just have a small, if it's a perennial weed, you know, there's you have to pull or you have to spray. I mean, it's really, there are no magic tricks. So it's either hand, you know, control, or you do have to use a chemical application. But if you do the chemical application, there are ones that are much, you know, I guess, less harmful to the environment. And usually the ones that are labeled with a caution are very safe chemicals to use. So when you're reading the label, just look for the word caution, and that's a good word. When you get to danger, poison, and you'd be surprised how many chemicals you have under your sink that are labeled danger, poison. Windshield washer fluid is a danger, poison. These are much more serious chemicals than a lot of times what we use around the garden. So watch that.
513-419-7100, and Steve in Clifton joins us. Hi, Steve. Steve, are you still there?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Sure can.
Can you hear me?
Sure can. Go right ahead.
Oh, thank you. We were talking about anyway, I just wanted to bring up that vines kill trees, and it was probably not helpful for bees either. And maybe you could use your platform here to let people know that if there are vines climbing up around a tree that looks pretty, but it's going to kill the tree.
I don't even think it looks pretty.
It
is a stress on trees. It's a lot of weight. It's a lot of competition. And it can be easily prevented just by cutting a section out of the vines on the trunk. It will take a couple years for the vine to die out and fall out of the tree, but it's worth doing. I noticed like Spring Grove Cemetery and Arboretum has done that with a lot of trees, and it's made a big difference down there.
Michael in Green Township. Hi, Michael.
Hi. I have a question about dandelions. I try to be bee-friendly and don't use chemicals for 25 years, just put up a bee house. But is there a time of the year that I can spray the dandelions to help try to control them?
Yeah, absolutely. As Steve was saying before, avoiding spraying when the flowers are in bloom. So as long as it's not in bloom, that's when the bees are not going to be visiting. The flower has to be open and fully in bloom for them to get the pollen and nectar source out of any flower. So doing that at that time, and then also right before a rain, if you have to do it when it's in bloom, there's been some research about how the chemicals have been washed from the bloom itself after rain.
513-419-7100. Carol in Hebron. Hi, Carol. How are you this afternoon?
Hi. Can you hear me?
Sure can. Go right ahead.
It's Carol, actually.
Okay.
Hi, Steve. Hi, Scott. I have a question for you. I set my phone to remind me Trees in Trouble would be on today, and I can't quite figure out what time and what station in Northern Kentucky on Warner, Time Warner.
Oh, I don't know that offhand either. It would be one of the public television stations.
Right.
And I believe you're right. I think it is on today. I don't know specifically when it is.
Tell us a little bit about Trees and Troubles.
It's a great, great half hour, documentary, made by, Andrea Torricci, who's been on this program.
Mm-hmm.
She worked with, Taking Root and, produced this, film, centered on Cincinnati, but addressing the big issue of the exotic pests that are challenging or threatening in many cases our tree canopy, and it's been terribly successful. We had the launch back in the fall here in Cincinnati, and it was aired on CET, and it was great. And since then, it's been picked up by PBS nationally. I think she's won a couple awards. She's spoken before Congress. So this has been a great, great thing. And, if I urge everybody to seek out that program and watch it, it's very well done.
And let's talk with, I believe it's Faye Marie. Is that correct? In Fort Mitchell?
That's correct.
Hi, go right ahead.
Hi. We have a black walnut tree in our backyard. We also have an above ground swimming pool that of course is rough fenced in. And I want to grow some, pollinating, attracting flowers or shrubs, what can I put around it?
I'm going to throw out one shrub that'll do under a black walnut. It's called calycanthus or Carolina allspice. If you see calycanthus or Carolina allspice, it's about a 5 to 6 foot shrub that blooms right now. Actually, it's in full bloom, and it's a good pollinator attractor. And I have seen that doing well under a black walnut. Again, I think stick with the tougher, hardier varieties. I know plants like azaleas, things like that, just won't do it under the black walnut.
I have seen I had the same problem, and I went online and Googled lists of which plants can grow under black walnuts, and the lists tend to conflict with each other and so on and so forth. But there's a few out there that I trust more than others. Cornell had a list. Any of the university research lists, I think, are probably a good start.
And I'd like to add another thing. You know, planting in containers, especially around pools, you can get a lot of beautiful annuals in container gardening. Plants like lantana and verbena, just beautiful plants that will attract butterflies and really do a nice job, especially for those small corner areas around your patios and decks. I don't think I've ever seen a lantana without a butterfly on it at the end of the summer. So that would be a great annual to use, especially in our Cincinnati hot summers in full sun.
Steve, going back to the list the zoo has created, can you give me a few examples of some of the plants that are on that list?
Well, perennials, going on a couple perennials, a beautiful plant in the fall is asters. There's one called October Skies, or Radon's favorite. That blooms late into October. Later part in the summer, there's a solidago called Solar Cascade. The bees absolutely love that one. And then the midsummer coneflower. There's so many good coneflowers. Echinacea. There's wild berry. There's powwow white and powwow wild berry. Bees, butterflies, they love it. In fact, this time of year, we've got a vine called trumpet honeysuckle. It's a native vine, scarlet red tubular flowers that really, that's what's going to feed the hummingbirds as they come through. So there's just so many great plants that we can be using to attract pollinators and really brighten our landscape.
One good thing about those late bloomers like the asters and some others is that they provide pollen and nectar to these insects at the end of the year when they really need to kind of fatten up, so to speak, to get through the winter. Right now everything's in bloom. Life is easy for a pollinator, but that's the time of year when they really need the nourishment. And that's not when a lot of people are growing their flowers. That's not when a lot of people garden. That's not a season that people garden for so much. So it's important to get some late season bloomers into your yard.
Let's talk with Barb in Loveland. Hi, Barb.
Hi.
Go right ahead. You're on.
I had a question. I'm kind of near Grailville in Loveland. I live in Claremont County, so it's rural. It's on the edge of the busy part, but it's rural here. And I didn't know. I had heard of a couple of people that said there were people who brought bees to your property. I don't have a lot of acreage. I just have a bit, but it's private and it's fenced in. And I didn't know if there's anyone who would want to put bees out on our property if we were bee friendly, but I don't know much about bees. But certainly they would be protected here, and they'd be within range of Grailville, which is kind of open and roaming.
I've heard of people hiring beekeepers to put bees on their lawn or even like in nurseries and things like that for pollination services, but it's something that you would have to pay them for. Unless if you had a good beekeeper friend that was willing to put in that time and effort to manage bees on your property.
And to wrap things up here, Scott, Party for the Planet, that was what, the seventh year the zoo has done this?
I believe so.
Yeah.
Seventh annual, yeah.
Give us the highlights real quick on the times as we wrap this up.
Good food, good beer, lots of people, great live music, free admission. Why wouldn't you come? The tulips are done, unfortunately, mostly, but there's still a lot in bloom at the zoo. It looks awfully good there. It's a good time.
Yeah, what are the hours for this?
4 to 8:30.
Okay. And Melanie, what kind of things can people learn about? Can they learn things about bees tonight?
Absolutely. I'm going to be there.
Okay.
We'll have a booth.
All right. So people can get all their bee questions answered at the booth.
Yeah, but there's a lot of other things out there, too, about sustainability, living green, and how you can be a good steward of the earth and just celebrate it.
Okay. Well, Scott, Steve, Melanie, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
From the Cincinnati Zoo and Botanical Garden, beekeeper and one of the founders of Pollen Nation, Melanie Evans, director of horticulture, Steve Foltz, and horticulturist Scott Berline, who's also chair of the Taking Root campaign.